Hi, this is Tiffany. Welcome to the 12th House Tomfoolery Podcast, the 12 Days of Tomfoolery. Say hi to the people, Kate.
Hi.
What's that wonderful noise I hear in the background? It's so spooky.
It is. It's very atmospheric. It's quite windy here in Detroit tonight, and I'm on the fourth floor of an apartment building, so the wind keeps coming in these, like, it actually is very spooky in these spooky gusts. As I said, like right before I talked to you, Tiffany, it was like super, super loud. But apologies, there's nothing I can do about that. So if it does show up in the audio, just
have
to be part of the atmosphere. Yeah, it's ambiance. Exactly.
It definitely actually kind of goes with my topic because I'm talking about something scary. Has anyone heard of Gryla, the Christmas witch? So she is Iceland's Christmas witch, and purportedly she is much cooler and scarier than Krampus, but to be fair, this article is wild and it's super cool, and it mentions a couple things that while we'll be covering in other episodes of the 12 days we're doing. So those who prefer Jaime, the darker side of the holiday season, have had it pretty good lately thanks to the fast-growing popularity of Krampus. Once a mythological character on the fringes of Christmas lore, the horned and hooved Germanic monster has gone mainstream in the U.S. There are Krampus parades.
He's major made cities. It big time.
You're Look a out, star, baby. We did it.
Baby. Yes.
You're a star, baby.
Put those hooves right on Hollywood Boulevard, baby. You got your own square.
He just beats your kids and says, well, that's show business.
Yes. Showbiz, baby. I love it.
So
I love it.
There's also an influx of merchandise of the long-tongued creepiness in a horror comedy film starring Adam Scott and Toni Collette. While Krampus may be the king of holiday scares, his fans may be overlooking an equally nasty and much more formidable queen, the Christmas monster who lives further north in the frigid climates of Iceland. She goes by the name Gryla, the Christmas witch. This is tough ogress, so she's an ogre, lives in the caves in Icelandic hinterlands, the matriarch of a family of strange creatures, launching attacks on nearby townships and snatching up misbehaving children to turn them into a delicious stew.
A delicious stew?
Yes. So,
you know, I was posting about stew all day today. Am I Gryla? I couldn't stop talking about stew all day.
Are there dead children in your stoops? Then no.
No. No, there's not. There's not.
If you can't find locally sourced children, you can just use regular meat. It's fine.
Yeah, ground chuck is okay. Or like whatever that steak. I don't even know what I use. Something cheap.
So Terry Gunnell, the head folklorist of the Department of University of Iceland, says, you do not mess with Gryla. She rules the roost up in the mountains. So, tales of the ogress began as oral accounts, with the earliest written references found in the 13th century. In historic sagas and poems throughout the region, one reads, here comes Gryla down in the field with her 15 tails on. While another describes, down comes Gryla from the outer fields with 40 tails, a bag on her back, a sword or knife in her hand, coming to carve out the stomachs of children who cry for meat during Lent. It's just popped right off.
Yes.
I know. So in Iceland, the midwinter holiday is called, it's spelled J-O with a little tick above it, L. I assume it sounds like Yule because it's a version of the old English word, an old Germanic word for Yule, which describes the time of gathering together and feasting, celebrating, which evolved into modern Christmas. So generally darker than the U.S.
Yeah.
The earliest celebrations of the season were viewed as a time to not only bring together relatives, living and deceased, but also elves, trolls, and other magical and spooky creatures believed to inhabit the landscape. Some of these figures would visit in the flesh as masked figures going around to farms and houses during the season. Gryla, whose name kind of loosely translates to growler, would be among these, showing up with a horned tail and a bag into which she would toss naughty children. Yeah, so she was certainly around in about 1300, not directly associated with Christmas, but associated with a threat that lives in the mountains. You never knew exactly where she was, says Gunnell. Long poems were written about her and her husband, but he didn't last long. As Gunnell explains, she ate one of her husbands when she got bored with him. And in some ways, You'll love this. And in some ways, she's the first feminist in Iceland. I love this guy.
I love it. I was just going to say, hey, maybe I like Grilo a little bit more. You know what? I'm bored of you. I've had enough of your tomfoolery.
Yeah.
Well, time for another stew. John, yeah. Let's go, Betty.
I like it.
It's really hilarious. Other bits of the folklore described a second troll-like husband and a giant man-eating cat called the Yule Cat, known to target anybody who doesn't have on new clothes, making a new pair of socks or long underwear an imperative for any Icelandic holiday shopper. So I actually will be going over the Yule Cat in another episode. I'm using Gryla to introduce her little band of misfits, we'll say. So I'll expand on that at a later time. Filling out what Ganel calls this highly dysfunctional family are Gryla's mob are of large adult sons, the 13 Yule lads, which I'll talk about in the next episode. Each of these troublemakers visits Icelandic households on specific days throughout December, unleashing their individual types of pestering. I can't even pronounce this name, so we're just going to do my best. Hurraskiller is partial to slamming doors. Potaskafil eats any leftovers from pots and pans. Oh, man, that's this me. One looks tough.
I'm that one.
Oh, gosh.
I'm here for the snacks.
Buna Kriker lives up to his name of sausage swiper.
Oh, maybe I'm that one.
Depends on the day. Gryla did not get connected to Christmas until around the early 19th century when poems began to associate her with the holiday. It was also about this time when the Yule Lads and Yule Cat, which had been standalone Christmas characters with no connection to the witch, then became part of her big creepy family. So prior to that, she was really a personification of the winter and darkness and snow getting closer and taking over the land, according to Ganel. Not only did she represent the threat of winter, she was seen as actually controlling the landscape. Ganel continues to explain that Icelandic people understood themselves to be more like tenants of her harsh environment, where glaciers, volcanoes, and earthquakes dominate, and would view mythical creatures like Gryla as the ones who are really running the show. And then he says, Krampus only wishes he had such power. So,
oh, I love it.
I know. It's Gryla amazing. Is an archetypal villain. And the fact that she's a matriarch makes her somehow more frightening, says Brian Pilkington, an illustrator who has drawn some of the definitive depictions of Gryla in the Yule Lads. And then it has like a really cute picture of like a Christmas ornament. And she doesn't, I mean, she looks a little wonky, but definitely not as horrifying as the story's going. So I'll post it on the page.
Oh, wow.
In the 20th century, as American Christmas and its depiction of Santa Claus proliferated through Europe and beyond, attempts were made to sanctify the Yule Lads. Their bellies were widened, their troll-like whiskers grew a bit bushier, and they required red and white for costumes. They also, like Santa, began leaving gifts rather than taking sausages and snacks and so on. I know. The Dutch tradition...
We're changing our MO, boys!
Well, so they got better marketing team. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah,
the Dutch
for sure.
Tradition of children leaving out their shoes and to find chocolate and treats the next morning was also influenced in this shift. So some critics tried to snuff out Gryla altogether, attempting to sideline the scary character with a more family-friendly fare. One popular Christmas song describes her death. In more recent years, Iceland as a whole, led by the National Museum of Iceland, has worked to return the Yule Lads to their pre-Santa roots, trying to get them dressed in 17th and 18th century style ragged clothing and bringing them back to the browns and blacks and local wool colors, as Gunnell puts it, looking like aged Hell's Angels without bikes.
Oh my God. Yeah.
This guy is really cool. The characters appear in person with adults dressing up like them to entertain and sing children who visit the National Museum. It's a little bit like hanging on to the language and traditions of that kind to avoid global Santa image, even if it has the same roots to the past. They'd rather hang on to the Icelandic version, says Ganel. And why not? Double down.
Yeah.
Pilkington, working alongside with the National Museum, has worked to do this in illustrations, including the Yule Lads, a celebration of Iceland's Christmas folklore, a kid's book about the characters that is ubiquitous around Iceland during the holidays and is in both English and Icelandic. I did not see this when I first checked this article. I might be getting that. Likewise, Gryla has proven a tough figure to dislodge with her likeness found throughout the capital of Reykjavik and beyond, sometimes in the flesh. and I'm about to wrap it up. But children are truly terrified of Gryla in Iceland, Pilkington says. I've visited I've visited children's play schools to demonstrate drawing skills. He's the illustrator. And if I draw Gryla, then two or three of the children, three terrified children, have had to leave the room because it's too strong for them living in the folklore. So Gunnell agrees that she's never stopped being embraced here. He says, as a living figure, you see her all around Reykjavik. She has never really gone away.
Wow. That's very interesting.
I'll post this link to the article so you can click on the different stuff and see all the pictures. But I just thought this was a really good summation, quick way to go over friend Gryla.
Yeah, absolutely. Somehow this parable makes Bjork make more sense to me in my mind. You know, Bjork's from Iceland. Like I love Bjork, but like she's so weird and like kind of creepy. I love her, but like she's a little creepy and she's definitely weird.
Right.
You know, I mean, I guess if that's like the culture, if you're growing up and it's like a giant,
you better be cats good, or sweep you. The Christmas witch is going to come disembowel you and make you into a soup.
Yeah.
And if you don't wear your new Christmas clothes, her cat's going to come eat you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty an intense childhood, I think. No wonder she's like in a swan suit, like, army of me, you know? She's probably, that's her fight back against Gryla and the Yule Lads.
I love that the illustrator has gone to several schools and drawn pictures and scared several children, and I guess continues to do so because he didn't make a point about it in the article. Oh, that's so funny.
I know. I love it. That is so funny. That is so funny. Okay, should I move on to my topic or?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, okay. Great.
Roll out.
We actually didn't go over this at the beginning of the episode. We kind of popped right into it. But this episode is the fourth house. And the fourth house is one of the angular houses traditionally ruled by Cancer. It does deal with the home, with your young childhood, with our deep inner parts of selves, our roots, kind of our soul. And it is the first of the water houses. And all of the water houses, 4, 8, and 12, are kind of mysterious. The fourth is the least mysterious, but it still is mysterious because it's like our inner roots. So I'm going to be doing a little story about a Christmas mystery, which I've read about this a lot of times. This could be a full episode. So it's going to be quick. It's going to be easy breezy. Not that many details, just kind of the formless, watery picture of it. But if anyone's interested, we can do a full episode because there's a lot more and it really is fascinating. So this is a story. Let us know, because I would love to do a full episode on it. This is a crime that happened on Christmas Eve slash Christmas in 1945. So the family was called the Soder family. They lived in Fayetteville, West Virginia. Both of the parents were immigrants from Italy, grew up in Italy and moved over here. The father moved a little bit later in life. The mother moved when she was like 3. Nobody could really figure out, and the dad never really owned up to why he immigrated over to America. He went with a brother. The brother went right back to Italy, but he did. And that's kind of like was the mafia thing? Was he trying to get out? What was going on? Because he was from Sardinia and there's a lot of mafia stuff going on there. So he moved over to America. He met his wife when they were pretty young, like in the early 20s. They got married and they just started popping out the kids. They got married in like 1921 or 22 and had 10 children. By like 1943. So 10 kids in 20 years. Really happy family. The dad does pretty well to do. He starts like a trucking company. He's his own entrepreneur. They do pretty well. So the kind of lore with this, and again, there's a bunch of different, you know, thoughts on this, but the biggest one is this guy came to try and sell him life insurance. And he was like, no, I don't want life insurance. The guy was like, well, you got 10 kids, you got this big house. Like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do if you die? He was like, no, I don't want it. And the guy was like, well, fuck you, fuck your family. Your children are going to die. You're going to get you. Yep. we're going to get you for what you've been saying about Mussolini, who was, you know, dictator du jour right. over in Italy at the time. This was all like witness. This was like a huge thing. So that happened like 6 months before this Christmas situation. There were some other run-ins, but that seems to be the one that carries the most clout. So Christmas night, they open up a couple presents before the kids go to bed. One of the kids is not in the house at all. He's like out of college. He's moved away. But it's the two parents and the nine kids are there. The mom was like downstairs and she was like, well, I remember seeing the light was on, going down, turning it off and locking the door. She goes upstairs at like two in the – or no, because the fire was at one. So at like midnight, they hear this like clunk on the roof. And then the next thing they know, she goes back to sleep. There's all this smoke coming in. So the house is set on fire. They get four of the kids out, but five of the kids are in the house. The dad is freaking out. Yeah, freaking out. He's like trying to break through windows. He's bleeding from his arms. He goes to get in his truck. There's two trucks. Both of them, the power have been cut to. He can't get either one of his cars to turn on. He goes to like call the police. The phone line has been cut or it was something like that. I can't remember exactly. There's like three things that he goes to do where it's like, this is not normal. Neither one of his cars this will is turn intentional. On something.
Right.
This is intentional. Like the power line was cut, things like that. So they call the police department then. And then I know it was like back in the day, but the fire is at 1 a.m. It takes until 8 a.m. for the police department to get there, which I get it's not going to be as fast as today, but that's a long time for the fire department to get to your house when it's on fire. Seven hours. Like, yeah, the house is going to be burned down. So the house is burned down and there's no remains. There's no remains. And as somebody who did have a house that burnt, like in the basement was completely desecrated, but like you could still see things, you know, that you could still see like outlines of things and there's no bones, but the fire department's like, oh, well, yeah, the kid's bones just must have incinerated in the fire. And they were like, well, no, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, right. And then the cremation place was like.
Yeah, cremation. It doesn't like 700 degrees has to burn for it to
turn bones. For what it's I read, lot. What I read is that a regular body in a cremation tank or whatever they're called, if it's at 2,000 degrees, which is, I guess, what they burn the body at, even after 2 hours, like the bones will very much still be there. And the house was burning for 45 minutes before the structure all fell down, not 2 hours, and nothing, right? No bones. So, so the family, this becomes until they die, really, this huge search for what happened to the kids. And all sorts of things come up with that. A bunch of people, because they bought all these billboards on the side of the roads, a bunch of people call in and are like, we saw him in Florida. We saw him with two Italian guys driving. The Italian guys had like, don't talk. This was like all over Florida. People are calling in and saying, no, we saw him. They called the FBI and the FBI was like, oh, well, we can come in and help if you're local to police, but your local police department has to okay it. Local police department doesn't okay it. They finally get like some guy to come in and test the remains. And they do find like three little shards of vertebrae from like a 14 to 17 year old. But the guy, whoever was doing it, was like, still no, this still is not the kids, because you would find way more bones than that from five kids. It's four shards. And they had like dug to cover up the burned basement. And he was like, it probably was from the forest somewhere. And it could even be from like an animal. It's just these shards of bones. Like, this is not proof these kids died. It's not, we would have found five bodies, not four vertebrae. The police chief department head then is like, well, no, I found, and this to me is so absolutely outrageous. He was like, well, I found a heart. I found the heart of one of the kids and I just threw it in a box because I didn't want to upset the parents when we were like looking over the crime scene. And the private guest investigator was like, okay, well, take me. So he takes him and he does find this box with quote unquote the heart, but it's like pig liver. And also, what a stupid like cover up, because if it's so hot that their bones have incinerated, this heart,
a whole just human heart.
Heart.
Get out of here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like 20 years later, because they, you know, I mean, they are doing everything they possibly can. They're going from different counties. They're offering rewards. They're trying to track down every single lead they can. The wife for the rest of her life wore black because she was in mourning, which I can't even imagine.
You know, you're,
yeah. And it's like,
there's no way.
There's no way. And obviously if you lost a child, that is unbelievably horrifying.
Right.
But the only thing I can think of that's worse is like not knowing and being like, what is my kid alive? Is it dead? Are they being tortured? Like that. I can't even like, I've got like anxiety.
I would never be okay after that. I would just constantly looking things up and hiring private detectives. I'd pour all of my money into trying to figure it out.
Yep.
I'd also be suing the police department because what the fuck literally are they doing?
Yeah. What the fuck are they doing? So in like the '60s, they get this letter, anonymous letter from Kentucky that has a picture of, I think his name is like, it's like something with an L, Luigi or one of the kids' names. And it was like, I'm with your son. And then like broken, it doesn't really make sense. But then there's a picture and you can see the picture of the son when he's a kid and this picture of this guy grown up. Obviously I'm not a forensic examiner or anything. They sure do look a lot like each other, like a lot like each other. So then they hired a private detective to go search for him in Kentucky. Never heard from the private detective again. So they're like, did the detective die? What happened? They put up billboards with the grown picture of the son. And then a lot of people came back and are like, okay, well, if the kids are still alive, why wouldn't they be reaching out to the parents? Why wouldn't they be trying to get back with them? But the biggest kind of theory to all this is it definitely was like a mafia situation. It either was he was in the mafia as a teen before he left Italy, or it was like they were trying to get him because he made quite a bit of money and he had his own business, or they were trying to like rope him in. Here. So it was like a mafia thing. And then they took the kids for I don't know what reason. Again, there's a lot more if we go into a full episode, but it's this whole mystery. And the four kids that made it out of the house and survived and were with the parents are still to this day trying to figure out
what the exactly mystery happened.
But
right.
Yeah. What exactly
those four
happened?
Kids too. Like you have to go through a fire. Your siblings are missing. Your mom and dad are losing their minds.
Oh, I know.
Oh, those poor kids.
I know.
Oh, those poor kids.
Yeah, everyone. It's just, it's horrible. And then obviously the rest of the parents' lives are completely committed to finding
their children. I just can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Be grateful every day for what you have, right? Think about what some other people are going through all over the place. Honest to God. Like I can't imagine from anyone's perspective in this story going through that. But it's a really fascinating story. And as I said, there's much more to it, but just the concept of it is, oh, and another thing I forgot, the ladder was missing too. He always had a ladder that went up to the window. That was the other thing. The ladder was missing. So clearly to me, I would say something was going on. Like these kids
like
did not die.
Like a very elaborately organized kidnapping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, he must've really pissed someone off. Cause I get that some insurance salesman's being an asshole or whatever, but I just don't see him having the wherewithal to come up with every single thing like that. This just sounds way too orchestrated. That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't either. I don't think it was like
one guy that wanting revenge. Yeah.
Yeah. But also, you know, I was trying to keep this short. Before that, there were somebody came to like check out their something in the back of the house and was like, oh, that's going to start a fire one day. You should watch out for your kids. And there's another guy that said like kind of the same thing. So I think it's been a while since I've gone down. A lot of foreshadowing. I if we do a full episode on it, I will go down the full vortex really hard, which I have before in the past. But from what I remember, the most like likely thing is mafia, and like all these dudes were kind of working in tandem. Mm-hmm. And it was like laying down the groundwork for certain things to kind of happen. So I think to me, it seems like a mafia thing. And right. Again, nobody knows what was going on in Italy. Nobody knows if he had ties to, cause like, there's gotta be a bigger reason. It can't be just this one dude. Like, he was well to do, but he wasn't Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. You know, there has to be like, I don't know if it was like maybe his dad did something and this is payback for that, but there mm-hmm. had to have been some sort of, you know, mafioso right. grudge. That's right. what I think. But it's really fast. It's just so interesting to me that even to this day, like, none of the kids have come out. No, nothing has ever come to fruition of like what actually happened. You would think by now something would, but nope.
This is why I had to stop watching shows like Unsolved Mysteries, because I would get irrationally yeah. angry when they never solved anything. I was like, this show sucks. I hate it. I'm like, it's called Unsolved Mysteries. What did I think?
Me too. And my mom, I remember when I would like watch it when I was a kid, and my mom would say the same thing. Like, you knew what you were getting yourself into, Unsolved Mysteries. But that's not really fair, because sometimes they are solved. You know, sometimes Stack would come back and be like, well, we've got an update. So
they good gotcha. On them for at least that's how back they gotcha.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. So do you want to...
There was... Well, just ahead. One quick question. Did you watch the newest Unsolved Mysteries? Like the Netflix redo?
I watched a couple of them, yeah. Not all of them.
Did you see the one that... There's one that takes place like 2 miles from me in Grosse Pointe.
I think I did. Was that the woman that
disappeared?
The hairstylist?
No, she wasn't a I don't think she was a hairstylist. She was a mom. She disappeared in the lake. Like, she like went to church. It was actually right around Christmas. It may have been Christmas Eve.
I don't know. There was one that a lady had a salon. So
I don't think that was it. But yeah, she went to the lake, and it's an unsolved mystery. She died. Nobody knows why. Her body was found in Canada. It's just, I don't know. Unsolved. Unsolved mysteries.
Unsolved. You don't say.
But I drive by. I know, right? I drive by where it happened like every day. So I see it all the time.
So... Perfect time to ask you, do you know why we decorate our Christmas trees?
Yeah.
Seamless. Oh, my Seamless. God. I'm so good at this. Yeah. So good at this.
Did you hear me said that completely in tandem? Seamless. No, I don't. But please enlighten me.
I am going to be reading you an article from Country Living, because I thought it was cute and it's pretty concise. So.
I love it.
Long before Christmas trees were considered the decor for the holidays, they were simply humble, fragrant evergreens that served as our source of joy during the harsh winter months. But what does the Christmas tree symbolize? How did it even evolve into one of the most celebrated icons of the season? Here, we'll take you through the most useful and interesting Christmas tree history. What does the Christmas tree symbolize? So, in ancient cultures, the winter solstice, which will be coming up soon, I think it's a week from today when we're recording.
21st.
Yes.
Right? Or 22nd? Herald,
yeah. It's the 21st, I believe. I looked before we shot
I think it's always the 21st. I think it's always the 21st.
Maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. The like summer equinox is June 20th. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay.
Being a bad astrologist right now. Yeah.
And that's what Google's for. Who cares?
Yeah.
So in ancient cultures, the winter solstice was heralded as the beginning of brighter days ahead, because it's the shortest day of the year, an indication that the sun god was regaining strength. Because evergreen trees retain their color through all four seasons, they were displayed and embraced in coordination with the solstice as a reminder of warmer months to come. In Egypt, a similar mindset was adopted. The sun god Ra typically grew weak as conditions became colder and darker. The solstice was seen as a turning point in the seasons, so Egyptians decorated their homes with palm leaves and branches. Similarly, in ancient Rome, a feast called Saturnalia was held during the solstice, which also exactly. We need to talk about that probably soon. Yeah. Which also encouraged people to celebrate springtime and bountiful harvest ahead with evergreen decorations. So, when did the Christmas tree originate? The true Christmas tree tradition can be traced to 16th century Germany, where Christians began to decorate trees, or if times are tough, as simple pyramid-shaped stacks of wood inside their homes. The tradition of adding candles to the branches is most commonly attributed to Martin Luther, leader of the Protestant Reformation movement in the 1500s. Legends suggest he was inspired by the stars in the night sky and wished to recreate the scene in his home using candlelight. According to a Christmas cornucopia, the hidden stories behind Yuletide traditions, the first ever Christmas tree was in London near what is now the Leadenhall Market. If I mispronounce that, I apologize. However, it seems it was a one-time occurrence as Christmas trees wouldn't be seen again in Britain until the 19th century. And in a different article I had read, it was like the 1930s, I believe, or somewhere along there. And it was Queen Victoria had one decorated in her home on like a broadcast they had put on TV. So.
Oh, so she's the one that like got it out there into the masses. Like the Queen's got a tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So where did the Christmas tree originate? Despite Christmas tree's roots in Christianity, most Americans refused to adopt the tradition at first because they believed it to be attached to pagan beliefs. The tradition was mostly contained to Germany until the late 1700s and early 1800s. Until then, the Puritans... Yes.
And also, as we've discussed, all of this has its roots in paganism. All of it.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Like...
100%. Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Until then, the Puritans, which we all know are super laid back, of New England, felt super chill.
Easy breezy, beautiful Puritans, yeah.
Yeah.
So chill.
Super chill. Of New England upheld very strict views of Christmas in America, shocker, and people were severely punished if they celebrated or decorated in any way. They believed the holiday was so sacred that a church service was the only appropriate way to celebrate. This solemn American observance of Christmas continued until Irish and German immigrants began to settle in America and establish their own traditions despite Puritan rule. Good for them. Puritans suck.
Hell yeah. Irish, exactly. And German. Woohoo! My people! I'm Irish and German. Yes.
Oh, wait. No, this article references Queen Victoria. So here it comes. There's a picture of it. December 1848, the royal Christmas tree is admired by Queen Victoria and Prince Albert and their children. And there's a linked photo. I'll post this article in the page if people want to see it, or I could just post the pic. German settlements, particularly in Pennsylvania, decorated community trees in the late 18th century, and soon the trees started to show up in the individual homes of German families. But most of the country was still skeptical until England's Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, who was of German heritage, were shown in a popular newspaper, so I misspoke, in 1848, standing around a Christmas tree with their family. That became the tradition more widely embraced. And just to round it out, where did the custom of decorating the trees come from? So, other than the candle aesthetic, which I'm just going to say really stresses me out with how flammable these trees are.
Do they put actual candles in the tree?
Yes, lit candles.
In the tree?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you were just saying candle is like a candle ornament. Like, no. I did not make... Holy shit. Yeah, that stresses me
real
out, too.
Real actual candles. Just... Yeah. Anyway, yikes.
Fire is a big trigger for me. Fire... I can't believe I actually told that whole story, because fire is a big trigger for me. That really, Yeah, it stresses me out.
I'm just going to move on, because I don't want to stress you out. Other than the candle aesthetic, already established in Europe, decorations like ornaments, often imported from Germany, became more popular around the 1800s. And the homemade decorations like cookies, garland, became more decorating staples. As technology and industrial... the pickle! Yes! Uh-huh. I actually need to get a pickle for my tree at my house. I'm going to get one this week.
Woo-hoo.
As technological and industrial developments progressed throughout the 20th century, the more homespun decorations gave way to glitzy electric lights and synthetic materials like tinsel. The popular shiny bright ornaments inspired by German imported glass ornaments marked the beginning of the U.S. ornament industry into the early and mid 1900s. So there's a quick little history on the Christmas tree.
Love it. I didn't know any of that. So I love it.
Yeah,
I thought
it was
so much about Christmas. I'm so glad we're doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, guys, Tiffy and Kate got to go to bed because we're getting old. So we're going to sign off. Do you have anything special you want to tell the people, Kate?
No, except for that this wind is getting more unhinged and now it's like ice. It's like ice raining. So it's like hail too. So keep your fingers crossed for me. It's pretty spooky outside.
Be sure to leave out a snack for Gryla.
Yeah. I'm on Gryla's good girl list. All I did was talk about how much I love stew today. So I got that going for me.
Maybe she'll drop you off a snack. Yikes.
Oh, I hope so. Some sausages, please.
I don't know if you'll like the ingredients.
I know. I'm
just going to think I'm going to say we love you and happy holidays.
Merry Christmas.
Meow.